Good afternoon. My name is Carolyn Aquia Lynette McCrary, and you all can call me Carolyn, if you will. And I teach at ITC in Pastoral Care and Counseling, the Department of Psychology of Religion and Pastoral Care. So we're going to continue from what this morning with this particular session, which is the clergy component, as we're calling it, and our intention this afternoon is to talk about pastoral care, what it is, pastoral counseling, and we're going to talk about self-care. Hopefully we'll have a good time for questions and answers. The main part of this for me is the persons who are here on the ground, the people who are here to hear your concerns. We have some information to share, but primarily it's about you all. So help us to know. Now Dr. Ed, I'll just confirm with him. We're very flexible. And we have things to share, if we will. But know that this may be, we're the clergy component, this is the spiritual side of people say. So we're very much in kairos, which is more God's time than human time. We're going to try to pay attention to chronos as well. But we don't know why it is that God has brought us here this morning. So we want to be open to that. As a way of starting and getting an introduction, and I guess once I want two people to step out, they'll be back in, and we'll let them come in and fill up and then over on this side. As a way of introducing ourselves and not to take a whole bunch of time doing it, but we're going to end up with self-care. Now, one of the ways that we've talked about in terms of just kind of getting started this afternoon is to say, introduce yourselves, yes. But a way of introducing yourself, give us a name, first name, last name, a whole name if you choose. Tell us how this Katrina, this Rita, I heard some people from here say now they call it what? Rita, some say? Just gonna put them together?
Cadrina.
All right, get the language straight. How it has manifested itself in terms of crisis. Now, if I say this, I'm going to be too talking the time for you all. But the way I was taught when I entered seminary, crisis, Dr. Nduku Tufariata said that in the Chinese language, crisis has two characters. You know, those things that look kind of like tic-tac-toes to us, but has two characters, and one character means danger, and the other character means opportunity. So I define, as he defined, crisis as a dangerous opportunity. So if you can introduce yourself in a way that says how I personally, probably, more so than other people, congregation, experience this as a danger, as a downside, then what was the upside? So what was the blessing? What was the curse? What was the bad? What was the good? And since we are that as we are, you can do that, and that takes us into your story, takes us into you, and help give us a glimpse of what you may have experienced. And be careful to talk about how you felt, if you do. Doesn't have to be long and drawn out. It can be two sentences. The blessing was that, and the curse was this. So the upside was this, the downside was that. That'll give us, and a name. So, I won't go by roles right now. Just who would like to start? I heard my brother over there. I'm going to give my amen call a chance to finish it now.
To begin with, and please excuse me, I'm enjoying this banana.
I'm happy about it.
My name is Takuna Tahaka. My downside was being in the convention center.
Oh.
I was in there for about 4 days, and I saw assistance, I saw helping. The other side of it, I saw insanity, I saw craziness, I saw anger, I saw rebellion, I saw hostility. I'm going to transfer from the convention center to the first stop that we made, Fort Chaffee, Arkansas. I saw the essence of what spirituality and connection is all about in terms of people we didn't know. They didn't know us, but they accepted us with open arms, and it was like, you are welcome. We are doing this. We don't have a reason, or if we do have a reason, we are doing this and we are accepting you because there was no color, there was no bias, it was just openness. And for me, at the age of where I am, this was the first time in my life I actually saw spirituality and religion in operation. And it was a beautiful, beautiful feeling. I don't mind saying several times I cried, I wept.
Yes.
It was just so overwhelming how to be accepted by complete strangers regardless of the color. That was my up and my down. And it was on the other side of it, it was a blessing because that was what I experienced. I grew from that. It took a little time. I had to get past that anger. But on the other side of the anger, I feel right now, standing here, it was a blessing and I grew.
I knew me.
Yes.
Yes.
No, sir, I'm not licensed clergy, but I've always been studying and always been reading. So this is where I am right now.
Yes, we do.
All right.
Come on. Yes. You'll fit right in.
All right.
Yes. Amen.
My name is Joyce Hines.
Swivel and pivot a little bit.
And I'm just saying this as I'm being led to say it. I am in mental health. I am a spiritual therapist. In mental health. I am from a family of ministers. And my father told me a long time ago that that's where I'm going to end up. I don't know, but I'm being driven. I know for what is where.
Come on, Ms. Walker.
I do have a private practice in mental health. And at the time that, but it's a long story, and I want to make this short just because everybody needs an opportunity to talk. But I see what happened with the Katrina as God giving us part two of his awareness. And I think part one was 9/11, where he told you what he could do with fire. And part two was Katrina, what he showed his people what he could do with water. And because I'm so into change and the driver of change, I know we as a people will not change until we are uncomfortable. And I think the familiar kept us so comfortable until we were not going to change from our wicked ways. And I thank God is saying until my people who are called by my name, until they would change from their wicked ways and humble themselves. And I think he didn't get our attention. But he's trying to tell us the only thing in this world that is constant is change. So he went all the way to New York to the highest building, and he showed you what he could do with his power. Now that thing at 9/11 could have happened at 3 o'clock in the morning when all of us were asleep, and then we heard about it on the news. But he made sure it happened in the awakening of morning when all of us were getting ready to go about our day. And he got our attention at 9 o'clock in the morning. They show you, I don't care how high, I don't care what the finances are, it can happen in a matter of seconds.
Now, pull us back into either one of those.
Okay.
If you choose that one, or Katrina, in terms of what has been the high and the low for you, or the good?
blessing and curse.
I think the blessing and the curse is that the chastisement that God is doing is getting our attention.
Got your attention.
Got my attention to bring me to my spirituality level. And he has my attention, so I'm being obedient.
And I'm hearing that. And I'm hearing you share that for us, that now that God has our attention,
right.
What? Yes, and I'm especially people on the ground too. I don't know, y'all, don't be shy. People who are here.
My name is Keisha Lewis, and the cursing for me is that when I'm a native Louisiana, but when both Katrina and Rita stuck, I was in Atlanta, and I just be preparing for my last year of seminary. Caught up in my studies, couldn't get home to my family, didn't speak to anyone from my family for about 4 or 5 days. Having left my children here with my parents while I was in school, not knowing if the flood had taken them, if they had been evacuated, what had happened to them. That was my cursing. But the blessing was that because of me loving my home, I was able to work with some of my colleagues on the campus and we coordinated the relief effort there on the campus of the IITC and actually got a number of the other schools at the AU Center to join in with us, and we were able to fill 18-wheeler with just all sorts of things. And then bring the 18-wheeler down, we made a stop in Jackson, Mississippi, made a stop in Baton Rouge. And when we got there to both of these sites, we were just overwhelmed. We still talk about it and smile and cry. Through our smile, because it was just so beautiful. We actually believed that we saw the love of Christ in what was going on in those relief centers. Mm-hmm. The people were just so warm and so loving. You see people holding perfect strangers while they were crying and rocking other people's children. And it was just such a beautiful thing. So that was my cursing.
Amen. Wonderful work. And you helped us to know it's not just New Orleans, but the whole Gulf Coast was affected. That's whose mom was there. Yes, sir.
My name is Jack, and I'm the pastor of St. Matthew's United Methodist Church here in the city. We moved here in June, right before the fireworks.
Yes, indeed.
The blessings, the curse, I'm going to start with the curse. It's been for us the a lot of personal sacrifice and change in our lives. And to see the impotence of organizational structures, whether you're talking church, government, city, state, just totally impotent. And that has been a curse in a lot of ways. The blessing has been, on the other side of that, to see where human compassion can overcome all of that other stuff. And to see how the successes have been in the grassroots people, in the grassroots organizations, in the grassroots of neighbors and neighborhood, and those kinds of relationships. And I think that's something for us to look for, that I have learned in terms of just personal relationships. People are looking for that care and that compassion that is just very grassroots organizational. And the larger organizations just kind of flip.
Isn't that something? Yeah. Huh. After the problems, when the two elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. And the grass will keep out on the back. Yes.
My name is Reverend Denise Moses, and I'm the pastor here in the greater New Orleans area. And I kind of have mixed feelings of some things, but I'm going to say the disadvantage of what I saw was that at the time that Katrina hit, it was a separation of congregations and pastors and families. Family members, and you had no kind of way of communicating. Nobody knew what this person was and that person was, and it brought a lot of fear. And that was a big disadvantage, especially as being a pastor, when you you had congregation, you had members, and you couldn't get to them. You didn't know where they were. You didn't even know if they were still alive. And they brought a lot of grief for me, and it really took, I'm still, even now, I must say, sometimes I still think about that, and it really brings a lot of pain. Because out of that, even when I did get a chance to talk with some of the people, and they were saying, and they were crying to me as I was searching for them, and the first thing they were saying was, all I wanted to know was, where is my pastor? Where is my pastor? And that was a big, 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 it really hurt me. It was somewhat of a curse, because it was like the brother just said, I was immobilized. I was impotent. I couldn't do anything, but these people were my congregation. So that, to me, it was like, I did like she was saying about the children. I took it on as a personal thing. I'm supposed to be here for them, but I can't do anything. But the blessing that came out of it was when we were able to come back together and we were able to share again. And as soon as we were able to get back into the city, we started back worshiping in our sanctuary and we began to give praises to God for sparing our lives and giving us the opportunity to come back together again. And from that day, we have realized that it's not just about us. It's not just about one body, but it's about what we can do in order to help each other to become the body of Christ. So a blessing has truly come out of that, even in the congregations that I pass.
Ashe. You begin up to speak, my sister, and then my brother? Yes.
I'm Sandra Martin. First thing I would like to say is Dr. Carolyn and Dr. Ann and Dr. Ed spun me out of the ITC in the class of 2002. In April of 2003, I accepted a call to the First Presbyterian Church in Scotland here, which is a little north of Baton Rouge. The way that the hurricanes and the aftermath manifested themselves to me were in joy and in pain. And the joy was the pain, and the pain was the joy. I have reflected back on W.E.B. Du Bois about the two-ness that we as people of color experience. Only my experience in this case was the truthness within us as a people of color. And it pained me to see how some of the haves among us responded to some of the have-nots, you know, who were suffering. And so the pain is, you know, that awareness. And the joy is that, you know, sometimes you say you don't know where the need is, you know, and you can't find the need. Well, God has made it clear where the need is. And so that is the joy, that we have the opportunity.
God,
Ashe,
Yes, thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Theron Jones. I am a native New Orleanian. This is home. It always has been, and it always will be. Whether I'm physically here or not, this is home. No one knows how to cook red beans like we do every day. No one knows how to do a bread pudding. No one knows how to put some ham hocks and some greens and fat, you know.
There you go,
Shaq. All over again. I think every generation has a mark of knowing where they were, certain events happened. To my parents, that mark came when they heard that President Kennedy was assassinated. They knew exactly where they were. They knew exactly where they were when Dr. King was assassinated. They knew where they were when Senator Kennedy was assassinated. They knew explicitly. My generation, I know exactly where I was the day of 9/11. I know exactly what I was doing in my classroom with my children. I know exactly where I was when I heard that President Reagan was shot. I knew where I was when I heard that the Pope had been shot. I knew it's here. It will never be. As I left New Orleans that Sunday afternoon, our ministry had a morning worship and made sure that all of our saints were taken care of, especially the senior citizens. I looked behind me and I wept as I left the city. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it was pitch black dark. And those of us who are native New Orleanians, we've ridden out many hurricanes before. But the Bible declares, my sheep, they know my voice. And as strangers, they won't answer. And the Holy Ghost himself told me, it's time for you, boy, to leave. Because I know me. And he had to come and talk to me like, see, he can't talk to me like he talked to y'all. Y'all are nice and cute, but he drew me out of some madnesses. He said, look. Oh, you messed it up. Out. And I knew my sister and family live in Alexandria, which is in central Louisiana. Normally, the way I drive, three hours of driving. I'm a mad driver. I admit, pray for me in those areas, my weaknesses. It took us 13 hours from here to Alexandria just to get there. But along the way, I kept seeing the hand of my Father. There's a story in the Bible where we saw the hand of the Lord on the wall, right? Everyone seems to think it was always a negative thought. God was limiting the amount of time and efforts and events to the people. But what I saw come out of Miss Katrina and Miss Rita were absolute blessings. Because in many cases, God had to catapult you out of this madness into places of blessings, not only physically, but spiritually, emotionally, and mentally. And that's what we are now. As a Red Cross worker, I think that for me the madness is I'm an educator. And I love crazy children. And I love inner city children. Say crazy. But I'm crazy. And so we get on with each other. You know, they take the medicine, I take mine. So we go, no. They come to you and they don't take their medicine, I took mine. We go, I'm imbalanced. So you take yours, I take mine. We all together. And I teach uptown children. I understand them. Because, you know, kids from the East, from the bougie kids, they don't pay for them. You know. I don't know where those children are to this day, though. Some of them, we've been able to maintain contact. I share all of my information with my children, my email addresses, my phone numbers and such. And I'll always keep my New Orleans number. I don't care where I live in life. I'll always keep the number. Because that has been a way of being able to identify those children and find where they are. But to not know where these precious children are. Yeah, they're high school students with these little children. They're some mama's child, some daddy's child. Hard-headed, yes, but they're still children. And to not know where those children are a year later, that to me is troublesome. But I still see the handwriting on the wall because even in my new profession working with the Red Cross, I am a client recovery specialist. I'm still dealing with people on a daily basis and helping Big Mama Den.
That's right. That's
right. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about. Big Mama Den. And you, Ian, Ray, Ray, Jamal, and Brandon. And, come on now. Don't make me call the roll. But when you know your people,
I
remember saying, baby, not only was I there, but I'm also lost. But we can't stay on August 29th. You know, it's August 2006. You still don't have a job. You're best to get a crew. And because I'm able to do that, I look at the baby, you can't be lazy no more. Sam, you know, FEMA has run out.
Yes.
You got to get together. The Bible says the man doesn't work, he doesn't eat. Cut out this welfare madness. There was a time when everybody worked. Everybody had a job in the house. And we can't go back, we can't regroup, we can't allow this storm to bring us back. That would turn the graves of our foreparents who worked too hard. Amen. But I still see the handwriting, I still see the hand of the Lord in moving this because there's a place over there. There's a place over there.
Thank you, Ryan. And, yes, you want to go next? And then what we'll do is we'll have one or two more, and then we'll kind of share, maybe in twos. We'll have some content, and then we'll kind of move back to this as we move to some self-care where people can put the voices in the total mix. So, and I want to invite my other brother, my young brother here, who want the youth voice and another persuasion. So I'm picking on you a little bit after. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm talking about you. He thought I was talking about him. That was smooth.
Let me just say that. My name is Emmanuel Smith. I'm the pastor of the congregation, 2100 Modern Chief Israelite Baptist Church. And let me say that even though I experienced personal loss of my home and other personal items, I don't see this disaster as being a curse in my life. I think that it was more of an awareness in my life. It was more of the fact that a God that I don't see physically saying to me and other individuals that we have been too tolerant. And I think that we found ourselves in a situation and living in a community and an environment that was out of control. And I think that God allowed what he allowed to happen to say to us that it is a time that we should reconnect, reconnect to our God, reconnect to our family, reconnect to our community, because we had got disconnected from the source that created us. And I think that the disaster brought that about for us, it helped us to gain a more, let's say, get us, I say us, let me say me. It helped me to gain a more intimate relationship with God, knowing what he wanted for my life and knowing the purpose for which I am created. And so that purpose is what I'm attempting to fulfill. I understand his mission. I understand the reason for my creation, and I know his purpose. And it all came about because of a disaster. And I'm not as tolerant as I was before. I'm not so insufficient as I was before. I'm more about my creator's will.
More sufficient. Interesting. More sufficient. I'm inviting you, so no. It's just an invitation.
Man, listen to everybody, there's just so much, but that's kind of what he said also. I thought about, was there a bad side, you know, downside, when I think these are everything happening by God's acting for permission with. And so I don't really think that there's a downside for me personally, because I gained from it. But even though we know things happen by God's active or permissive will, that doesn't mean you don't sometimes feel hurt or pain in the body. And one of the things that I kind of feel pain about in our community, in our mosque in the city of New Orleans, I accepted Islam at like 19. And I joined the nation with brothers at the same age. So we went from, I watched us go from being single with no job to getting a job to being married at a young age, having children and developing ourselves. And we formed those relationships, but now since Katrina, many of those brothers and their families are in Atlanta and Houston. So there's a part of me that misses them. But the good part of that is that it really showed me how God takes care of his own, you know. And because everybody they found themselves in an even better position than they used to be. So that's another good thing. And another hurting part of it was watching the television and seeing our people suffer. You know, it really, really hurt me. And not only that, to see our people suffer, then ask the question, why did it take so long to get us? And I was like, man, what did you expect? You know, so that was with me. And the good thing that I think I appreciate the entire experience, because it showed something, it helped me learn about myself. You know, they say that during times of trial, you really see who you are. I didn't shrink, I didn't run. And I'm only just made 31, and I'm a minister over community. So by God's grace, we didn't lose any of our community because of the organization that we had internally for accounting for one another. But I just appreciate, I even see this meeting here as just a product of Katrina. So I appreciate all of this. Katrina, you know, we wouldn't even really, we're still talking about mental illness, but it's still, Katrina makes this a little bit even more special. So I just appreciate everything that I've learned. Yeah. It's made me just appreciate life, and I'm alive.
Amen. Amen. Ashe. Well, I would like to say we won't stop, but we'll just kind of put a pinpoint in this part. If we appreciate God. And folks, and sisters and brothers, I saw Dr. Burnett, she walked that way, so she'll be back in just a moment. And we'll move to the panel presentation, and I'm going to kind of cut mine short and short. It's on the paper, and people who have questions, we can talk about what's on the paper, because I really do want to hear other people's voices. Maybe during that time, people can speak and hear voices, or maybe during our question and answer time. So if we'll kind of move to the panel, if you want to come sit down, I'm partial, y'all, when I sit behind the table, but I will if y'all make it. Sit up here, you know, behind the table. Or maybe we can just kind of go like we are. Yeah, and not have to worry about being behind the table. But Dr. Burnett will come in, and the structure that we're going to go with, as soon as Dr. Burnett comes through, we're going to talk about pastor care. We're going to talk about pastor counseling, and Dr. Burnett is going to bring us a medical perspective. Getting a pair of glasses and having a back of pair, but in case I lose these. Okay? Now wondering if you all would look at your second document, actually. Let's start with the second document, the overarching discipline of pastoral care. And like I said, I'm going to, since you have it right there in front of you, at any point, you can say, well, we'll go back, or maybe when I finish this first part, then if there are any questions. But we were thinking that, and you all happen to know, we have the seminary graduates here. If this is old hat, I know this. I've done pastoral care, so I didn't hear my sister's voices here. I'm just anxious to hear, I really am. And so just kind of move on through that little piece right there. We don't spend much time. But we wanted people to know that clergy persons were probably doing pastoral care, and faith leaders and church membership, they were doing pastoral care and may not have even known it or called it that. So help us to really focus in on that. When we talk about pastoral care, especially in the academy, now we look at some of the founders. Now, Dr. Thomas J. Pugh, and I kind of put those words, but the relationship, when I think of Dr. Thomas Pugh, relationship, that was the key for him for pastoral care. And that's what Brother Tahaka, yes, was identifying for us, that when the aftermath, you went to that second place of sanctuary, it didn't matter color, yes, religion, no, it was the relationships, the connections. And for him, first and foremost, it was the relationships that we had. And I think those of us who get older and older, we come to see what things might, you know, things are things, but who you got to love you, and who do you love, and who you care about, and how many people, or you get some more people to love you, and you're trying to love some more people, it gets to be the most important thing in the world. Dr. Howard Thurman, some of you all, many of you all probably familiar, the most prolific writer in African-American theology, actually. I always talk about a sense of belonging. And that's that for him, he said that everybody wants to have a sense of belonging. Here again, I think about that in relationship to Katrina and reading what has happened here. I mean, what happened to people's sense of belonging? Did they felt connected to persons and places? I'm almost hearing an absence in you because you all belong together. And now you don't know where they are. So belonging is not a place physically, it's back to the relationship. To whom am I related? And a communal concept of pastoral care, and I put part of Dr. Wimberly, we have him here, another prolific writer. The reason he started off with a communal concept, because in the West, a lot of times, in Western psychology, theology, and whatnot, it was more individualistic basis. So, and know you all that some people thought that pastoral care meant that they still do, they come to class. I want to come to class, but I'm not a pastor. Okay, this breaks that particular myth. Everybody does it. Everybody does it. Whenever persons minister one another, name of God, the nature of pastoral care, bringing to bear upon persons and families in crisis, the total care and resources of the, and I put in there, religious community. So it's a communal concept that everybody does. And in my classes, I talk about the fact that you all, even for those of us who did not come from Ellis Island, for those of us who came over on the slave ships as enslaved Africans, that was pastoral care on those ships. And prior to the ships,
yes,
back on the East Coast, West Coast, South Coast, of Africa. And the fourth one, I've been wrestling with this, I thought about the woman might get a chuckle, the divine embodiment of interdependence among sisters and brothers. I guess if there's a norm in my counseling, in my academic pursuit, it is reaching find a way how to unpack that word interdependence. Number one, in the West, you're not supposed to be dependent. Bad thing. But in many Eastern cultures, African and Asian as well, they recognize, wait, come on now. We're all dependent upon one another. Sweet Honey in the Rocks got a song about you know, how I'm dependent on the woman in South America who made the collar that goes on my shirt that I wear. I mean, she traces it all the way down. That's how dependent we are upon each other. So the whole notion of being independent, that self-made woman, self-made man, I did it all by myself, the Western is an illusion. Okay. I won't get politics. It's a lot. Thank you. I didn't say that. He said that. She said that. But John said that. It's a lot. And two, also helps me. Oh, I get to flirt. My sister said praying first this morning. Oh, I'm just all up in that prayer. La philosophie bantu ondes de lettres by Alexis Kagame. And this brother out of Rwanda, back in the 50s, writing this book, talking about, and you see Bantu, and I'm gonna move on, but that word Bantu, you know, we heard of Bantu people, we talk about, Bantu means human, and that's what they named themselves, they said Bantu, but they also had words that incorporate that into, the Kintu, the Hantu, all of those, meaning that everything is connected, because I'm connected to this chair, to this building, to this air, to this water, to this tree, I am connected to everything. Again, it's an illusion to think I'm not. Now, so we go back to any of those, as you see, and of course there's more to be said about pastoral care, but those kind of form some of our perspective. Three essential ingredients of pastoral care, and I won't read them, but listening. Whenever you get to the point and you care about somebody, you say, well, let me just shut up and hear what they're saying. Then you're off in the pastoral care. Let me just hush. Because I've been trying to talk. And I see that my talking is really not being helpful here. And I seem to be talking too much, and what I was getting ready to say, that's not what was going to be helpful. So I'm glad I didn't say that. You've gotten well off of the path from here. Because you have to learn to just be quiet and let people talk. And let them know that you are hearing them. In Kiswahili, there's unasikia, which is the same words, but it's a different intonation. So, it's unasikia, are you listening? And then unasikia, do you hear me? Like our mamas used to say, mine, do you hear me, girl? And when my daddy said, do you hear me, girl? I'm listening and I'm hearing you, daddy. And then unasikia, do you understand? And the young people, when I did a workshop the other day, they told me, they said, oh yeah, that what they said, we say, you mean? You do you hear me? And they told us they just go straight through to the end. Empathy.
Excuse me, ma'am.
Yes, please.
One of the experiences that we have dealt with institution is the institutional building. I know in the United Methodist Church, for example, we kept trying to get the bishop and all those people making all these decisions about New Orleans. Well, come over here. Listen, come over here and let's have a town meeting. Let's listen.
Hey, y'all, people who
in fact, too, me and another pastor called a town meeting of Methodists and informed the bishop and the DS, y'all come and come because we're going to have it.
That's right.
And we're chastised for it and everything. And we had over 200 people show up because they wanted to tell the story. But the ability of the institutional level to want to hear that story has just been, and that's been a struggle that we've experienced as pastors still, because they're coming in from afar telling me how things are, and we just say, you can't do that anymore.
Yes, it is. So they'll know what people need. done them all. And probably cares.
The people can tell you what they did better.
The people can't tell you. I mean, those of us, remember, that was the first thing they told us. You know, go see what the people need. Let them say it. So listening in those high levels. Okay, empathy, it goes beyond sympathy. I think most of us kind of know pretty much that. And confidentiality. Cannot stress the importance of confidentiality. Somebody tells you something, you have got to keep it to yourself. Now, unfortunately, pastors and ministers have gotten a bad reputation for either tough time getting in the pulpit or going and running and tell somebody. But I pray that paradigm is changing. That we don't see a need, because you really can't tell anybody. Well, I just told my deacon or my steward, or I just told, you know, my sister or my brother, I just told my wife or my, you can't tell anybody. It's a person's private. To me, your feelings are probably the most sacred thing that you have. Yes.
You know, the biggest problem I have kind of with this is that before they come to us, you don't told everybody.
Oh, that the person who's in need of care, right, they would have already told them. And if they have chosen to tell other people, then that's their business. And then how are you going to be different to them? As a fact, because talking about something sometimes can be very therapeutic for people. And I know this when I was going through my down and out and depressing and suicidal, I was just telling everybody. Everybody that would listen to me, I was just talking, just telling them, just trying to. And when I did run into someone who would hear me and then reflect back to me what I seemed like I was saying and feeling, that was helpful. So if you can be a different kind of hearer than those other people, because that's what they're doing. They're looking for somebody who's not only going to hear their words and hopefully not, maybe not tell, but they're looking for someone to hear them at a depth where when you do speak, you can ask them or say something that will cause them to further reflect on what they've said. This morning, talked about meaning. So what's the meaning in it? What's the lesson in it? What are you feeling? Primarily, people get to talk to you about what they're feeling. Because some people say, oh, I never thought about what I was feeling. I felt that she should have. No, not she should. What did you say? I felt that he shouldn't have. No, not. I'm feeling what? I'm feeling angry. I'm feeling ticked off. I'm feeling frustrated. So you get them to actually claim to know what they're feeling. Then they can document that, because they'll know the day where they stood, where they said what I'm really feeling. They will. Okay, now, I'm gonna really rush through this. So we've done crisis, that's what comes next there. Two kinds of crisis, the developmental crisis, situational crisis. Some of you all probably know, even if you didn't know, the two kinds is delineated, that as you look at birth, all those things are life crisis that you go through in your family, going to school, going to college, everybody leaving home, all of those, just regular. But then you get to situational crisis, all the ones mentioned there, plus you get Katrina and Rita. Now, even people who've been through hurricanes, you've heard that this morning and you've heard that here. They sat through Betsy, they sat through Camille. But this one is different. So how is this time different? Then the four historical concepts of pastoral care. And modified by Ed Wimbley in his book, African American Pastoral Care. Sustaining, I'll just say briefly, sustaining is like the doctors, in a sense, who say, well, just don't do any harm. You know, don't make matters worse. Try to at least be there enough so that you can abate the suffering. Maybe it won't get any worse. They know that somebody is there. In my opinion, in theological language or religious language, you can be the incarnation. Incarnate, meat, flesh, incarnation. You can be the presence of God so that this person knows I'm not alone. And for me, that was the most critical thing. When I found out, and God, y'all, when I found out there were books to talk about what I was going through, I was like, oh, Jesus, I am not by myself. That within itself was a relief and stopped the kind of downward spiral. So when we can be with people here, as you all have probably been, the guiding piece helps persons to make confident choices. And that piece about you help them. So when they say, well, And you all help me here. I want to try to go into that. Those of you all who have been with people, and yourself as well, I really don't don't have anywhere to go. I don't have anybody, and you can start saying it's from you all. Probably some of you all did. Well, now, just where did you come from? And now, who do you know? And you're gonna keep your cell phone number, because that from now on, because it might be 2 years from now, somebody may call you back on that number. Well, I don't know whether to go to stay in New Orleans right now. Christmas on the rise. Do I even try to fix up my house here now? Or do I just move on out? Or do I stay and try to hold this land so people don't come in and just take all our land? I really don't know what to do. I'm caught between leaving and going to a new job and just leaving this behind and staying here to maintain my family land heritage. So you help them. Now, this is a choice. This is a choice. And you help empower them by letting them know that they have choices. And then talk to them about the ramifications of their choices. Reconciliation seeks to reestablish broken relationships between person and God, person to person. And I put down there also within yourself, sometimes you can be so fragmented yourself inside that you need reconciliation. And healing consists of binding up the wound, repairing damage that has been done as a result of disease, infection, etc. And knowing that ultimate healing, I put this in there because I experienced a, we used to call greater the greater monster. And that was the most trauma I had been in until I went to study and went to teach in Kenya, East Africa, and there were refugees there from Rwanda and Burundi, the Hutus and the Tutsis. And it became more evident to me that sometimes ultimate healing does not involve physical cure. It's not cure. Healing and cure is not the same thing. And sometimes a person's body may die, but healing can yet occur. So if you can be with a person in such a way that in those last days, moments, hours, that they can find meaning, they have someone to really hear them, that they can start, Howard Thurman might say, begin a healing process, because Howard Thurman says 100, 2 years from now, your soul keeps working on its issues. So you can you be there as a part of their healing. And the healing might not be the leg or the gangrene or the, and we heard that this morning, a lot of people did die after the stress, maybe not with the water, she said. So the healing is real broad. 4 miles of path to care, I just kind of say them, the shepherding approach, which Hilton talks about tender and solicitous care. That's what I like about his definition, because I think that people who are vulnerable, who've been through, you really got to be tender. And when people tell you, well, we're not even coming to hear you. We're not even coming to listen to us. I don't be tender or solicitous. I'm not for it. The wounded heal concept deals with, you know, pretty much taking those, like, you know, it's phenomenal just to have heard you all here this afternoon, how much you talk about it being a blessing, what you've learned, what you've gone through. You know, most of us from our family, like the people over here, they're discussing this whole thing down, you know, just no right and left. This is the worst thing for them. And here, you all are able to talk about an upside, about the blessing part. So the wounded healer will say you take those scars, those hurts, those wounds, and you use it to help heal other people. Brother said he's got a monster, 31. So the narrative, of course, you have mentioned that this morning. Can say more, you all can ask me right here, talking about plots and storytelling. And womanist care, let me just say, the womanist versus feminist. Feminists kind of make the critique of life through maybe just genderized, you know, just male, female, and you know, we don't need women to be abused and violated, which is true, but the womanist approach says that you have to at least have three perspectives, three lenses, and one lens is to look through the race, because we must look at the fact that even though we might be different, whatever, but there are dominant powers in predominantly white United States of America, not number-wise, but power-wise, and that it puts people of color at a disadvantage. So you have to look at the color issue. But you also look at the gender issue, which male, and being in a patriarchal society, men get everything, supposedly men are better, men get, men are, men are supposed to, sons are the best. So we do critique the gender, make the gender analysis, but then there's also class. There's a third, at least a third critique, because here, now, you all help me out, maybe in our discussion, here in New Orleans, Ninth Ward, living right under the levee. I don't know if any rich people lived in the Ninth Ward. There were.
Because the Ninth Ward starts at the top of the bridge and goes to South Ward. It's the largest, all it is a political district.
Yes, and yes.
It means nothing less than whether you're the 17th, 24th, 36th, you know what I'm saying? Just political districts. Exactly.
Oh, it's your lower nine.
They don't have that. The retirement house about used to be all white. The kids moved out, moved to Chalmette, which is a trailer or two, and moved out of the desired housing area to the Chalmette area. So all that area was in commons. Hoping you get to know that.
Yes.
To know what they call for.
Yes. Health teachers. Y'all pick that back up so we don't see not that, even that. So the class originally in the Ninth Ward was rich and poor. But lower ninth was poor. So there was still a distinction that was just the lower ninth. So we in Womanist Theology, Womanist Pastoral Care, we recognize that we must know some of these issues and distinctions by class. Okay. And the importance of referrals, and I wanted to highlight this one to say, and this is where we make the bridge between us and mental health and other health professionals. If you recognize, know the advantage of broadening the support base for those seeking care for oneself, I didn't want to put on the paper I started to. Just don't try to be Santa Claus. You can't be everything to all people all on the same day. It's not good for you and it's not good for me. You even take that assumption. And that's why we show a lot of suffering for ourselves, because we just come off the Santa Claus pedestal. And you can just help as many people as you can, and then I'm going to bed, I'm going to get in my boat, I'm going on the other side of the purse.
I think the point that we can learn from in terms of class is that the two things that were underestimated in the metropolitan area was the amount of crime in the whole area and the poor. How many poor disadvantaged not get out of the city. And I think those were the two things that we saw fester to the top so quickly that they were both kind of underestimated, but in terms of response.
I would agree, because the vast majority of people who could leave on the voluntary evacuation left Saturday. It's right. Math. If you had a way off means off, you left. Whether it took you 13 hours or 5 or whatever, you left. It was, as his brother was saying, but of the poor, Medea did. Mm-hmm. Plus, in New Orleans, I think, they said, you don't need a car. Right. This city is a 24-hour city.
Right.
Mass traffic runs 24 hours.
24 hours.
Yes.
Buses and streetcars. So even if you work in a hotel, you don't go to that shack. Where are the bus? Yes. They may take you.
No, long.
Yeah, the broadband officer may take you the last time at 3 in the morning, but you still got a bus time, and you know it keeps a fairly good schedule. So most people don't need a car. And then those who are the projects, if your whole rent, including utilities, is only $50 a month. Well, the whole rent and utilities. So you can afford to keep a job working at the hotel at $6 an hour and earn a decent living. Because the majority of your money is spent on your family needs, not on utilities. But I take you out of here, I put you in a city such as Central Louisiana, all white, put you in a trailer park, and said that 57. No public housing, no jobs, no nothing.
Big difference.
Folks understand that.
Big difference.
Even with our children.
Big difference.
In New Orleans, only two around the yellow school bus children who are in special education. Because in New Orleans, every child who goes to school, public, private, parochial, rides to city buses.
That's right.
You give it two tickets a day, one in the morning, one in the evening, plus 25 cents for a transfer.
Everybody.
And then you go to the country, these same city kids, urban kids, black, white, white, all, like on yellow bus. It's in their mind, they've always been taught. All the kids on yellow bus are crazy. But now you go on yellow bus too.
Wow.
Back to class.
Wow.
What did you see? You saw saw the tail of two cities.
Come on now.
That's what you're saying.
That's right.
You saw a city where all the systems were broken. Mm-hmm. And needed to be repaired.
That's right.
Everywhere. And don't talk about crime, because crime, but before you get to the crime issue, you got to go way back to the home issue and to the education issue, you know, before you ever get to crime. And so we see the result of something that was broken prior to them getting to that point.
Right, and which is what Dr. Rubin kind of, when they invited us to come to talk about trauma and re-trauma, there were people who were being traumatized here before Katrina and Rita. And
you haven't dealt with the blacks versus the light blacks versus the dark blacks versus some of the white blacks yet. All of us.
Well, light blacks versus dark blacks versus the first one.
The
last thing you
said, some of the white. In the Illinois club.
Stand up and turn around.
In the Illinois club, see, you may could halfway qualify.
Oh, he said you're dark.
He's not passing the passe blanc.
He's not passe blanc.
No shack.
No shack.
No,
no passe blanc.
He can't get in. But because he's still too dark, no.
Uh-huh.
And he ain't from the seventh wall. Seventh wall, which is where all the... Who lives in New Orleans? Y'all got to have it out here. Now, my dear here, mother here, no disrespect to mother, can make it in. In the Illinois club.
Everybody else?
Yeah.
And definitely.
Straight up.
What year
are
you talking about now?
206. We're talking about right now. We're talking about right now.
206. I'm talking about 206 and 205 before Katrina came. And still not. So that's the main.
Yeah. What happened is that the people had become tolerant of the system. And so it was okay with everybody. It should happen that way. I shouldn't be there. I can live. And so this younger generation cannot be made for the future. We ain't.
And, you know, they are
ain't. They don't care about color. They don't care about neighborhood. You know, the same thing is happening across every neighborhood.
Young people want to hear more about what they, well, okay. So the young people started even pre-Katrina to say, that ain't right. Okay. Yes.
They still suffer.
You got the charter system, you got the New Orleans public school system, you got the recovery system, you got the same school system in Oregon.
Right? You can tell a child, I can give a writing assignment to this day to all the kids in my classroom and tell them, don't write your name on the paper, and can identify what child lives in what neighborhood based on this writing style. Because they talked to it. They responded to the same writing assignment because of what has been said
for years.
You knew because you were this color. If you're dark color, you couldn't even apply to Santa Fe lesson for the most part. It just goes well out.
St. Augustine is
Catholic high school.
Black Catholic high school, all male.
That's what you pretty well knew if you what you thought it
is. Save the press.
Go ahead.
Yes,
sir. Save the press. Save the press. The dark black girls. St. Mary's is a light-skinned black girl.
That's right. 2005.
So, brother, we're not talking pre-Katrina.
We're talking what?
We're talking post-Katrina, the same system. Our name put in place. And so we still want to have the same mental and mental walk.
Yes.
Going up here.
Which is a good, we talk about bridges to that, you said the same mental. So there are mental and emotional ramifications to the whole, now we would stop paper bag round, that's what we did, paper bag.
Yeah.